In this week's programme, Eminent Elizabethans, a book by Piers Brendan, formerly keeper of the Churchill Archive Centre. One of the four eminent Elizabethans he profiled, Margaret Thatcher, has gone to her reward since this programme was recorded. Any doubts our contributors may have had as to who the most eminent among these four Elizabethans is will have been dispelled by the reaction Mrs. Thatcher's death provoked. A little under a century ago, Lytton Strachey wrote a famous book called Eminent Victorians. He chose Cardinal Manning, Florence Nightingale, Thomas Arnold, and General Gordon as heroes worthy of debunking. Piers Brendan has chosen four people that haven't been awaiting debunking by him: Rupert Murdoch, Prince Charles, Margaret Thatcher, and Mick Jagger. With me is the journalist Conor Brady, former editor of the Irish Times and author of Up With the Times, Helen Shaw, MD of Athena Media and producer of the media show on RTE Radio 1. Professor Cullum Kenny of the School of Communications at DCU is the author of several books. Conor, what did you make of Eminent Elizabethans?
Well, it's immensely enjoyable. The language is extraordinary for its viciousness, its poison.
So you took pleasure in some of the hatchet work, did you?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's designed for that. I mean, it's intended to be a dose of poison. What's interesting is that not much of the poison is actually original to Piers Brendan, but what he has done is he has most assiduously pursued quotes and assessments
did that bother you, that use, that perhaps some might say overuse of material?
No, I don't think so. I think it betokens wonderful research. I mean, he quotes, for example, Edward Ducan, the great high Tory grandee, describing Margaret and Dennis Thatcher coming to dinner like a couple who've applied for a job as a housekeeper and a groundsman. It's wonderful language. It's a very English book. I've tried to think, could you do an equivalent Irish book? I think it would be difficult. It's written for that particular society where people don't actually know an awful lot about many of these prominent figures. I think in this society, everybody knows everybody
too
well.
That's interesting. You think we know more, do we, about the our public figures?
I think so. I think so. Maybe I'm wrong in that.
Yeah, Colm, on that very point, Colm.
Well, I hadn't thought of it, but I actually disagree. I think Ireland would be ripe for a bit of debunking of some of our sacred cows and a little bit of background. To be quite honest, it seemed to me that the author in this case, although he pans the internet describing Wikipedia as a monument to incontinence, it had the feel to me that he had mined the internet left, right and centre and pulled together a lot of material that isn't originally sourced insofar as it's sourced. It's quite broadly attributed to other people who've done the work. And while I agree with you, it's certainly a very enjoyable book in many ways, I couldn't quite grasp the overall concept that he had here. And
You mean in terms of conveying the spirit of an age or whatever, that kind of thing?
Exactly. I think Lytton Strachey had debunked people, as you say. I don't think he really debunks people. I mean, he does.
They're already debunked, of course.
Well, that is part of the spirit of the age we live in. It's this self-deprecation that people project as a kind of anticipation of criticism that manages to disarm, to some extent, this kind of irreverent approach because they've already taken it in their stride.
Yeah, we'll return to that. Helen Shaw, let's hear your reaction to it.
Well, in some ways, it's good as a mix of a panel because I really didn't like it. And in some ways, what Conor is saying in terms of the book and enjoying it, I disliked it in a way that I dislike this form of journalism. He calls them himself acid etchings. I found it nasty, based on gossip, innuendo. When I go to a biography, I want an insight. I want to go into the motivation and the reasons behind a character. And with this, what you got was a lot, as Colm is saying, compilation of everything else written about them, potted little histories. And in some ways, yes, they're entertaining. They're entertaining in that way that when you see somebody fall, it's that schadenfreude, that and you feel actually deeply unpleasant afterwards for even enjoying that moment. when he quotes somebody as saying that Jerry Hall was like looking into a mirror, that, you know, he's deprecating to the point that what you get is a lot of bile. And in my experience. It just left a bad
taste. Were they all in your, to your mind, equally bad, or did any of them?
No, I think that's really important, because somebody asked me about this because we're doing the media show. Hmm. And I said, I actually would recommend the Murdoch chapter, the Murdoch biography, because I do think it brings together elements of Murdoch which are quite useful. I've read a couple of the books because obviously that's my sector and interest. So I've read a couple of the biographies about Murdoch. But I found that very interesting. I thought he was weak on Charles. And in a sense, I don't think he gets Thatcher. I don't think he gets women at all. And he simply hates Mick Jagger. I don't understand why the four of them are together. Yeah. I don't understand why he thinks this represents a picture of an age. I don't see them as eminent Elizabethans.
Yeah, well, so what names occur to you that you know, he might have done?
Well, in some ways you start to play with that, and I think that's fun. We could all do that. And sure. In some ways, what Connor is sort of saying here, and you immediately think if you did it here, if you had a gun to your head and you had to pick four people, who would you pick? Before we even do that, because that's a good game, is that one of the things that really I found annoying about the book, and maybe it's because I am a woman, is that he's drawing on the eminent Victorians. So we have Florence Nightingale as the woman of the four, one woman in four there. He himself does the eminent Edwardians, one woman, Emmeline Pankhurst. And in this again, in a story which is of the 20th century, a story when women, if nothing else, come into their own, we again get one woman.
So what woman? Let's stay within the sort of British purview. What other woman would you have in there?
I think when I've said the Charles one is the weakest, if he felt he had to do a royal and it wasn't the Queen,
Diana.
I would have done Diana.
Right.
He talks about Diana in a way which, having, as much as anybody, read an enormous amount about her, it's like he really sums it up continually by saying she was bonking mad.
Yeah, Connor, who would you have been there if not those four?
From Britain?
Yeah, those four,
It would be very difficult. Yeah. I mean, I don't know.
Pretty emblematic.
Victoria Beckham or somebody, I mean, who actually has actually done something with her life. I honestly don't know. Funny, I found Helen says he's least good on Charles, and indeed you're right in that. There's less about Charles, and yet I think Charles comes out of it in some ways as the most commendable of the four. He overcomes enormous disabilities of natural disadvantages. I mean,
I don't know but he zeroes in on a key contradiction of Charles, that he yearned to be a people's prince, yet expected them to genuflect. I mean, that's very much
it's paradox,
Peter, isn't it? That's their kind of, isn't it? That idea of wanting it both ways.
Yeah, I thought he was taking easy shots. You see, this is part of the issue here. I felt myself that Mick Jagger was actually the best. I certainly enjoyed it. And he establishes very much the basic theme of the book there when he takes Jagger and talks about him being a masquerade of mutiny, because that's part of his approach, that people who appeared to be rebelling weren't really rebelling. But I think actually if he wanted to interrogate and challenge British society the way that Lytton Strachey did, he needed to do it differently. He needed to take targets that do need debunking. And I thought in that context, for instance, he should have debunked the kind of have it both ways on the EU politician. And he could have taken Cameron. He could have taken the easy pot shots at spirituality and religion. And he could have taken someone like Dawkins and done a good job on him. And perhaps some of the stand-up comedians, perhaps if you wanted a woman, Jo Brand, who is so self-righteous in her approach, that she would be ripe for this kind of debunking. So I think he took a very predictable approach.
I presume in 100 years,
the second
Helen,
richest
yes.
woman in Great Britain, who is J.K. Rowling. So, I just think you get the sense that he decided, because he is somebody who loves to write biography, many of them are in his territory, and he brought them together under this umbrella of these supposed agents of change who actually resist change. Mm. But Paul McCartney, to my mind, would have been a better match than Mick Jagger. The thing that I found interesting about it, he's really critical about Murdoch and his obsession through the Sun and the News of the World with sex and purity and porn, in a sense, with the Page Threes. And yet, in every one of them, there's this almost schoolboy obsession with the sex lives and the language of their sex lives.
Does he tell us what drives Murdoch? I mean, the interesting question about Murdoch is, isn't it? Is it money? Is it power? What is it?
Well, interestingly enough, there's a new biography of Murdoch by David McKnight at the moment, and it's very interesting. It poses, it's posited on that question, and McKnight, who is an Australian academic and knows the Murdoch seed, breed and generation, as it were, comes down very firmly on the end that it's money and power, ideological power and money. And the sex thing and the titillation of that is.
But which is which? I mean, when one says power and money, Colm, I mean, is it? Do you have the feeling that it's really power? It's really wanting or influence, rather than money. It's not money, is it?
I don't think it is money. Certainly, the money involved is staggering when he gives figures and he reminds us that the Wall Street Journal was bought for $5 billion. I mean, you have to pinch yourself and to DirecTV for $6.6 billion. It's immense. But I agree. Oddly, he's a driven individual. I'm not even sure power is always the explanation. I think what he does do is he hints at some of the personal background, the conflict between the Protestant ethic and the family that could possibly create contradiction.
What do you think drives him, Helen?
I thought that was the thing that was interesting, because psychology is always what interests me in biography and in documentary making, which is what we do. And in some ways, the two grandfathers, this Protestant puritanical influence and then this Irish, much more gambling. And he has these twin poles in him, which is almost at one level when people describe him the lovable rogue and then this driven, puritanical, hardworking to the age he's at. But I mean, I don't think you can ever, and even if you think about when you meet people like that, that it can never be described as solely money. It is, in a sense, we're making a doc at the moment about the lockout and William Martin Murphy. So you have that sense about influence in your lifetime. I mean, you have a sense with Murdoch that this influence is not just political. It is about building. It's empire building.
This is the point. As to his ideology, I got the impression it wasn't until he started Fox that he became the extreme right-winger we've come to know. You know, I sense...
Well, he developed the Sun, of course, as the great instrument in the UK. I mean, basically, he is a radical conservative who wants to drive the Western world, the English-speaking world, back to values that he holds dear. The Sun was the principal instrument through which he sought to do that in the UK, and with some success. Fox News in the UK, in the United States. But I'm not sure that it's... I think there's something of a false dichotomy to ask whether they're interested in power or money. They're interested in both, in my experience.
Yes, but I mean, you can grade them, though. Of course they're interested in both, but it's the question of which was the more important.
If they were to be left with just one, I suspect they'd prefer to be left with the money.
Never with Murdoch, would you? And we mustn't forget the Chinese wife. Well, I mean, you know, there is a view abroad that the Chinese are getting their pound of flesh here as well. There's some suggestion, I mean, even among the more conspiratorial, that Wendy Deng was part of their grand scheme of things, the Chinese.
When you read that chapter as well, that's the way, in a sense, the wives are dealt with in the Murdoch story. It doesn't actually stack up. And in a sense, without knowing these people, there isn't actually any sense that he married her, which is what he suggests, in order to create greater influence in China and build his empire.
But
relationship. He also dismisses the Thatcher marriage as being a business relationship.
Yeah, but the point is, maybe the Chinese had an interest in her marrying him with a view to influence in the West.
A greater conspiratorial paranoia than I currently have.
Yeah, okay, there's a wonderful line where in that piece where he says, she, that is Wendy Deng, made the sexagenarian glow with pleasure and excitement by taking him to a barber who cut his hair for less than a dollar.
I gather she calls him Lupert.
Do you think, by the way, that he is the most important of the four figures? You don't think in 100 years who will emerge? At Thatcher, I suppose.
Well, I'm not sure. I think he attributes too much agency to Thatcher in a way. And indeed, Thatcher was the least hypocritical of them. I mean, whatever else one can say about Thatcher, she did seem to believe what she said. But I think she was very much of her time, of a movement that wasn't her responsibility, in a sense. Things were happening in the global economy around her, as illustrated indeed by
you
the
don't
story.
Do, sort of Helen, yeah?
No, I don't. I do think Thatcher will last. If you're looking at this from a historical perspective, Murdoch probably won't. And it's interesting in terms of what happens to people who create great wealth and power in their life, like the William Martin Murphys, who in a sense are written out. It's Larkin's statue that sits in O'Connell Street. Thatcher is a historical player. And in some ways, I think I would disagree from the basis that she was totally reactionary to events. She also really shaped and created events, even if, as I would personally, beyond the different political viewpoint to her, that in a sense, if you see that period, it is a very distinctive and decisive period in what happens in Europe.
I just make the point it's Larkin's statue is in O'Connell Street, but it's William Martin Murphy's newspapers that are still read in much greater numbers.
But it's his reputation we're talking about in a sense.
There's one marvellous...
Who'll be talked about 100 years from now?
One marvellous line from her... when she says, when the Norman Fowlers of this world believe they can afford to rebel, you know that things are bad. That's a wonderful line.
I think it's just worth coming back, though, to what he's about. The methodology of the author here.
Yeah.
He doesn't claim to be doing comprehensive biography.
Well, sure.
He describes these as vignettes, and I think in fairness
But I'm
to
asking you to improve on him, Conor.
Yes. I think he describes very well what he's about. He says that the Elizabethan era, the second Elizabethan era, is best represented in miniature. So that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to reduce it. Now, there's only a certain distance, obviously, in which you can go in reducing any era or any particular civilization. And then he makes the point that, as Helen has said, he's clearly antagonistic to the internet era. He says, but the glut of knowledge obscures truth and darkens understanding. So what he's trying to do is, as it were, abstract a small amount of information, a small amount of knowledge, focusing on a smaller amount of people, and thereby to illustrate the age. Now, of course, that's an enterprise doomed to failure. It can't succeed.
That's really in difficulty in the Thatcher chapter because so much is happening. It's such an intense period that if you read that, you end up, you know, and it's particularly if you haven't, as we have, lived through it, you actually would get quite lost because he's moving timeline continually through it. It isn't chronological.
Do you agree that she was lucky in two senses? One, that Jim Callaghan did not go to the country in the autumn of 1978, and second, the Falklands War came along at a time when things weren't at all going well on the economic front. She was rescued by luck, you could say, two important instances, Colm.
She was rescued by luck. She was also in touch with the direction of her times. Mm. I think it's nonsense, this conclusion, that her most notable achievement was to divide the nation against itself. Britain was divided against itself. She brought out those divisions, but those divisions would have emerged anyway due to the pressures, economic and otherwise, that Britain was experiencing as an emergent nation. And if I could just, you know, make this point again, that I think we have global developments occurring that were bigger than a number of these people. I think a key point in the book is when he discusses Murdoch's involvement with the Chinese. I mean, we talked about his Chinese wife earlier, but much more significant in the sense of what's been happening in the world during the past 30, 40, 50 years is the way in which Murdoch was prepared to do the deal of the devil with the Chinese and basically to self-censor his media operations in China in a way that some others have not been. Google and Facebook, for instance, have put up a much better battle there. But Murdoch, for all his talk of freedom and wanting to break all the rules and all the nonsense that Fox goes on with, and what a terrible channel that is. I mean, just watching it again in New York 2 weeks ago, every time I see it, it just shocks me.
Didn't one of his companies, Foal, move on Chris Patton's book? Chris Patton, who had written a book at the time, and the Chinese objected and... they withdrew it, I think, that performance.
Yes, and he made sure his satellite service wasn't going to carry the BBC news if that was going to stand in the way of
one
money.
Thing that's very interesting about him is the way that he posed as an outsider, Conor, and yet, you know, reaped all the benefits of being an insider, Murdoch, that is.
Yes, I mean, his background was very, very privileged. Mm. He was raised in conditions of considerable affluence. He had every advantage of the most exclusive education of his time. Well-connected family. But we've touched on this earlier on. There is that almost evangelical Protestant resistance thing there. portraying himself as an outsider, portraying himself as somebody who wants to take on elites as he sees them. And of course, this was the leverage that he used to build the Sun in the UK, to build Fox in the United States. These were the media turning back. He was using the media, as he put it, to take on the liberal elites, which he claims have dominated world media. And there's a market for that.
Who did you like least, Helen, of the four?
At one stage when I was reading it, I was sort of saying, who would I least like to be trapped in an elevator with? And I actually decided it was Piers himself. But, you know, the funny thing is, I think that's it. My reaction was to him because of this, particularly the purient element of continually the obsession with the sordid and the sexual. And, I mean, the use of lines like, at one stage, he quotes all these other people, which, in a journalistic sense, it was always a way of getting you away from the condemnation of the dirt you're throwing. So it reminds you of that kind of really horrible yellow
press.
You
have to admit, some of the quotes were very good, though.
But, like, the Thatcher one. So Healy said she was Heath in drag. Soames called her Ted with tits. Admirers retorted she was Heath with balls. If that isn't misogynistic, even in a repeated framework, I don't know.
I thought Jagger came out of this.
He really dislikes
badly,
Jagger.
You know,
yes, that's great.
Posing as a social revolutionary, but really was a money-obsessed chaser of the aristocracy at the end of the day. I mean, he was the one who... I mean, if you look at someone like Bowie, he had a vision of some kind. There was some kind of artistic journey there. Nothing, you see, it seems, going on, according to Brendan, in Jagger, of that order.
I never much liked Mick Jagger, so I thoroughly enjoyed his... I didn't find as much sex in the book, unfortunately, as Helen seems to have. But certainly
in the Mick Jagger chapter, yeah. I mean, we get everything from the Mars bar repeated to the size of the equipment.
Well, I didn't notice. I did rather like the line. There's one in the Murdoch piece about them trying to drum up some story about cannibals and shrunken heads in some island between Australia and Asia.
By the way, Helen, it was by Bianca, not Jerry Hall, who led to an intensely narcissistic phase in his life, in the sense that she looked like him. I mean, that was the idea.
He says that.
I think
it
was Bianca.
There's a quote that he quotes, I think, Richard saying that Jerry Hall was like looking into a glass, i.e. suggesting that she wasn't the brightest in the group.
She had her own money, which
but,
meant,
you know, again, meant, it's not the impression you get of Jerry Hall. Don't know her personally. But I just think the whole language and conversation about women in the book, about Diana as well, who literally just gets dismissed continually as mad. There's nothing else.
Yeah, she's very hard on Diana too, isn't that right? In a kind of throwaway style.
But she's hard. I mean, he's hard on everybody. Diana is only a walk-on party, really, and certainly she doesn't get a lot of sympathy. But I'm not sure that the book is the book isn't about this isn't about sympathy for anybody. I mean, this is as I said at the beginning, it's a collection of poisons, and everybody is subjected to it. I mean, the Jagger one is probably the most poisonous, and he strips everything away from Jagger's reputation. The rebel turns out to be a coward. There's an extraordinary passage about the very flamboyant user of drugs who gets convicted in Chichester Court, and suddenly the possibility of having to spend a time behind bars is presented to him. He's described as thoroughly cowed, white with fear, a nervous wreck, rigid with terror at the prospect of a term behind bars.
Yeah. So who are the four Irish figures of the last 50 years, Colin, that you might work on? Maybe you already are.
I think we'd need notice of that, Andy. I think.
I just make
the point that I think, you see, we know an awful lot about our figures. We know which politicians, you know, are tipplers and topers. We know about the private lives of people in a much smaller, intimate society. I suspect that your average chartered accountant travelling on a train from Staines into London every day reading this would be astonished by this kind of stuff. Whereas somebody coming in at the Dart from Dalkey, if we were to read it about, you know, Irish politicians or public figures, would say, sure, everybody knew that.
But that doesn't square with the fact that he quotes so much. You know, that would indicate that the stuff is
very well covered. I think that's, to be fair to him, that was the thing that I puzzled most about is that there's lots of really strong biographies written about all of these people, and in some ways there's more than one. So if he was, he's purposely gone for people who are quite well known and done these concise, as you say, vignettes, almost bringing them all together. And sometimes that is incredibly wishy and entertaining. He has a great turn of phrase.
But not a single...
But from my perspective, it left a bad taste.
Not a single fresh insight column on any of them, on any of the four, really.
I have to say I thought not, no. There, apart from the fact that I didn't realise Rupert Murdoch had lived in Cavan, I thought that was interesting. that turned out to be the name of his estate, of course, somewhere in Australia.
The Irish ascendancy, we've decided now, explains Murdoch, obviously.
And you're for Helena?
For here?
Yeah.
Definitely, my lawyer would have to be quoting those. There's names that would come to mind, but probably you'd want to run them past the editorial committee, Connor, wouldn't you?
I'd nominate Andy Manning myself. Yeah.
I mean, are there the people, Hoey immediately springs to mind. After Hoey, among politics. Too easy,
The mass, you see, one difference, of course, between this book and the original Eminent Victorians was when the Eminent Victorians appeared in 1918, they were all dead, it was in the past, so it was safer. You didn't have to worry about the lawyers. So it would definitely have to...
Yeah, but who would you, among the politicians, who would you have?
Well, it would be... Well, I suppose if you really wanted to go for Sacred Cow, it'd be Sean Lamass, which would be a pity, because, I mean, we've already debunked so many of our Sacred Cows and have so little confidence in our body politic.
Yeah, Dermot Ferriter has done De Valera, so you end up in an environment where... I mean, I think Cahy would validly still stand up, and you're definitely starting. If you say they're all having to be dead, that does confine it a bit to some that were in my head, which have more to do with probably the last 5 years and Namaland. But if you're in that environment, I think it is interesting he talks about his four in the past tense. So even though they're not dead, he chooses to describe them as if these are obituaries.
That's
appearing in the Irish
you're quite
Times.
Right, yeah. You're quite
We've
right.
been discussing Eminent Elizabethans by Piers Brendan. My thanks to Conor Brady, Helen Shaw and Colm Kenny. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie or on the RTE player. Till next week, bye-bye.